Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Frank v. Walker. Mr. Koski.
May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Clay Koski on behalf of the appellants, and I have three main points. The first point is with regard to the relief requested. The state is requesting that this court reverse the judgments of the district court and vacate the permanent injunction. In the near term, the state is asking that today this court stay the injunction to allow the law to go into effect for the 2014 November election. Second, the voter ID law is constitutional. The district court found that more than 90% of registered Wisconsin voters already have a form of qualifying ID. In spite of this, the district court misapplied the Crawford test, inappropriately discounted the state's important interests, and concluded that the law cannot be constitutionally applied to those who already have an ID. Third and final point is that the voter ID law does not violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The test that the district court applied was novel and inconsistent with the plain language of Section 2. The district court created a test that is focused on likelihoods and probabilities rather than on results or causation, and the evidence at trial did not show a violation of Section 2. For all these reasons, the judgments of the district court should be reversed. With regard to constitutionality, I'd like to start with the state interest. But before I go there, I want to say that this law makes common sense. In entering this courtroom today, I was asked to show a photo ID. And I asked the marshal what would happen if I did not have one. And he said that he would turn me away. If I want to go to Walgreens today and buy Sudafed, I have to show a photo ID. If I want to board a commercial flight, I have to show photo ID before I get through TSA security. All of these activities are less important than voting. But yet the critics of voter ID would say that a voter ID is something that shouldn't be required. I would argue that this law makes common sense. The first state interest I'd like to discuss is the state's interest in orderly administration of elections and promoting voter confidence. A recent poll by the Marquette University Law School showed that 63% of Wisconsinites favor voter ID. This is consistent with other polls throughout the nation.
What conceivable relevance is a polling number to this litigation?
I think it's relevant to show that in terms of the Crawford interest that the U.S. Supreme Court recognized, it's relevant to the interest in promoting confidence in the integrity of the election process. So voters who favor this obviously do so rationally.
Popular laws can be unconstitutional. You would agree with that?
I would agree with that, Judge Tinder. But this one is not. The second interest I'd like to talk about is the state's interest in preventing and deterring forms of fraud. This law helps election officials determine that the person who appears at the poll truly is who they claim to be. In Wisconsin, it is very simple to get a ballot. All you need to do is show up at the polling place, state your name, state your address, and sign the poll book. Usually what happens next is you're handed a little slip with a number on it. You take that to another table, you hand that slip to the person, you get a ballot, and you vote, and you're out the door. This law makes it much more difficult for someone to come in and say that they're someone else. Again, it's a common sense measure that promotes confidence in the election process and actually will make it easier for people to vote. The third interest that I'd like...
How does it make it easier?
Well, for example, I have an unusual last name. It's spelled K-A-W-S-K-I, and they can never get it right. So if I show them my ID and it has my name on it, they can look at that and say, oh, well, there you are, right on the poll list. It makes it a little bit faster. So I think it does make it easier.
There's no data behind that, though, is there?
No.
There's no study to show that you get through the poll quicker with a photo ID.
No. It's common sense. The third interest that I'd like to emphasize that the Supreme Court again has recognized is the interest in improving the integrity of the process. It's related to the voter confidence, and all these interests are actually related, I would say, under Crawford.
Right. I don't think the real dispute here is whether those are valid state interests. I think everybody agrees that those are valid state interests. Crawford told us that those are valid and, in fact, important state interests. The question is how they're weighted or balanced against the burdens of the voter ID law. So maybe you could focus in on that.
Sure, I'll focus in the Constitution. I'll focus on that then. As was recently observed in the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision in NAACP versus Walker, the district court here had the analysis turned on its head. The way the district court should have done the analysis is first determine whether this law creates a severe burden. And in fact, nowhere in the district court's decision did the district court conclude that this is a law that creates a severe burden subject to strict scrutiny. It simply didn't go there.
The question is, how is that burden properly measured under Crawford? Mm-hmm. We've got a plurality opinion in Crawford, and then a concurring opinion by Justice Scalia, and Justice Stevens' opinion takes a different approach than Justice Scalia's opinion. And so we really don't have a clear signal from the Supreme Court about how this burden is to be measured, whether it's measured against the electorate as a whole or whether it's measured against subgroups of voters upon whom the burden may fall more heavily. And what's the proper unit of analysis, for lack of a better way to put it?
The state's position is the proper unit of analysis is voters generally. That is the approach that Justice Scalia took. And I would say in reading Justice Stevens' opinion, what he does is he says this law can't be struck down facially, and it's because we don't know the magnitude of the burdens. That is very similar to what occurred here, is we don't know the magnitude of the burdens. There's no finding that, even to the nearest 100,000 voters, how many voters will be unconstitutionally burdened. All we know is that the district court found that approximately 300,000 Wisconsin registered voters do not have an ID.
Well, is it just a quantitative analysis, or is there some sort of qualitative analysis as well?
There is a qualitative analysis as well, and that also illustrates how the district court's fact-finding was lacking. The district court observed several anecdotal examples of types of problems that people might have in obtaining an ID. For example, problems with obtaining a birth certificate, traveling to the DMV to get the birth certificate if they're indigent, they don't have money to get there, or a means to get there other than spending money.
Well, we do know that the hassle factor is not really a burden that the Supreme Court considers significant. That much is clear from Justice Stevens' opinion in Crawford. So we're really talking about something different other than the difficulty of getting to the DMV neighborhood station and applying for your free voter ID.
Right. I think what we're talking about, one of the problems that was observed at trial is that people either don't have a birth certificate or can't afford one. And there's no fact-finding in the record to show that there are X number of people who can't afford to get a birth certificate.
Right. Well, and we know that the issue of cost is now off the table with the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision.
That's a very good point. In fact, as of this week, the Wisconsin DMV has instituted a new procedure for consistent with the NAACP decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which will allow people to go into the DMV, and if they show up without their birth certificate, the DMV, if the person was born in Wisconsin, will contact the Department of Health Services and will basically ping the DHS to see if there is a birth certificate on file. And if there is, they'll come back and say, verified, and the person then gets the product for voting. That's not going to cover every problem, obviously, because there are some people who weren't born in Wisconsin. But our position is that the number of people who will even have to use this exception procedure is very small, especially based on what was found at trial in this case. So, Judge Sykes, when you talk about the burdens and the magnitude of the burdens, that is precisely the state's point, is the trial findings here don't show that there is an endemic problem.
Well, the cost issue, as I said, is largely off the table, completely off the table, I think, in light of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision. But there is still a question of the exercise of discretion on the part of the guy behind the counter at the local DMV.
Right.
And, whether we want to trust our voting rights to that guy behind the counter at the local DMV is an important question here. But they do have some discretion about whether to exercise their discretion in a favorable way and issue the free voter ID
right.
without the supporting documentation. And so there will be some people who fall through the cracks.
I would say that the number of people that could potentially fall through the cracks is infinitesimal. And I want to tell you more about what the DMV is doing. Yesterday, Governor Walker approved a final administrative rule which would allow for an extraordinary proof procedure for those who do not have documents to approve their or to show their name, date of birth, or U.S. citizenship. And the documents that are now included in that petition procedure include things like baptismal certificates, hospital birth certificates, delayed birth certificates, census records, early school records, family Bible records, doctor's records of postnatal care, and then, quote, other documentation deemed acceptable to the administrator within his or her reasonable discretion, which goes back to your point. There is, of course,
well,
some discretion.
Well, you see something of the problem. Would you file a copy of that with the court?
Yes, I can file a copy of it with the court. And it is available online through the administrative rulemaking website. As far as I know, I was just informed of this last night.
I'd like you to file a copy of with the court for those judges who may not have access to computers.
I will do so.
Or know how to use them.
I will do so. So Judge Sykes, kind of to wrap up, as the constitutional claim, we think a key problem here is that the district court didn't start with the analysis in the correct way. The Anderson verdict test requires the court to look first to the character and magnitude of the burden. Our position is that this judge could not analyze the magnitude of the burden because all he said was there are 300,000-ish people who lack ID. He didn't say that, and by the way, there are 20,000 of those people who will have experience extreme burdens in getting a birth certificate. We just don't know that. We don't know. All he said was that there are a substantial number of people who will be negatively impacted. We don't know what that number is. So it's almost impossible to do the balancing test with those kind of facts. And I think there's a reason for that, because the evidence at trial showed examples of very unusual burdens. And the district judge's opinion talks about 8 particular examples that are extremely unusual. For example, one of the examples that we talk about in our brief is a man named Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. And on his birth certificate, it says Eddie Jr. Holloway. And when he tried to go to the DMV to use that to get an ID, and they had a problem with it. There's no evidence in the record or fact-finding regarding how many people are going to have a similar problem like that with their birth certificate. There's a handful of people that the district court talks about with these highly unusual problems. But we just don't know what the magnitude of even that kind of burden is. Similarly, we don't know the magnitude of the burden that people face because they need to pay money to get a bus ticket to travel to the DMV. We don't know how many people are too poor, or that would be too much of a financial burden on them to travel to either the DMV or another agency to get a document. We just don't know that from the fact finding. And that is not, it's just unhelpful in the Anderson verdict analysis. When we have these important interests that the Supreme Court recognized in Crawford, it's as a matter of law. They recognize these interests. But the district court inappropriately discounted those interests in the balancing test analysis. I'd like to turn to the Section 2 question. I think this is a very interesting question. Our position is that the district court's analysis focused on something that is not part of the statute, which is whether there are likelihoods of probabilities of things happening. The district court's analysis can be summed up as follows. There is a history of racial discrimination in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. Because of that, there is poverty in the minority community. Because of that, minorities are less likely than whites to need a driver's license or other form of ID. And then because of that, that these folks are going to be without ID to vote under Act 23. You notice in every statement, we're talking about likelihoods. We're not talking about direct cause and effect relationship. The statute itself talks about...
I'm not sure where this argument is going. The district court made a finding about the bottom line. District court said 2.4% of white voters lack either a photo ID or don't have a birth certificate in hand, so it would be harder for them to get it. And 4.5% of black registered voters, that's true. Let's just take those two numbers. Those aren't likelihoods. Those are the bottom line of that process. Mm-hmm. So one would think, therefore, that the legal question is whether that sort of difference, a 2% actual bottom line difference between whites and blacks, and a somewhat larger difference between whites and Latinos, is enough under Section 2. That is what I think you need to address your discussion to, and not talking about these intermediate points. Since we know the bottom line, let's talk about the bottom line.
Sure. I think that one point I'll make there is that we may know the bottom line, but what that doesn't tell us is that these, for example, if you're comparing whites and blacks, what that bottom line doesn't tell you is that that same group of black voters will be unable to get an ID or will be extremely burdened. It just doesn't tell you that.
No, I don't want you to talk about whether they can get one. Mm-hmm. I'm just asking you to talk about the legal significance of the current state of the world. And that we have findings about what the current state of the world is. The district court said the legal significance of that is that this law is invalid under Section 2. I'd like you to address that.
I think the way I'll explain the legal significance is by citing you to other circuits which have addressed this issue. In particular, the Ninth Circuit has addressed this issue, and they said that demonstrating some relevant statistical disparity is not enough to prove causation under Section 2. And these are cases I know are cited in a lengthy footnote in our brief.
You lose me. Okay. It's not a question of showing causation. If you don't have a photo ID, you're not going to be able to vote, right? So I'm trying to figure out what the legal significance is just of this fact. It's not whether it causes something else. It's what is the significance of this fact?
The significance is it shows that there's a disparity in current possession rates.
Right. So is it your argument that a 2% disparity or a 3.5% disparity of whites compared with Hispanics is not enough, just as a matter of law, ever?
No, I think that in this case we would say it's not enough. And the reason is that...
Well, we can't, you know, in this case, we have to take these facts and apply some legal standard to them. I don't know why it would be not enough in this case and enough in some other case unless you can articulate some legal rule that would make it not enough in this case and enough in some other case. And you seem to be very shy about articulating a legal rule. I think I understand the legal rule the plaintiffs are arguing for, which sounds like even 1/100th of 1% difference makes the law invalid. But I don't understand what legal rule you are advocating for.
Right. I would say we're not advocating that there's a certain percentage cutoff, if that's what you mean. For example, that a 2% disparity is not enough, but a 25% disparity would be enough. It, Judge Easterbrook, it requires you to look at what's going on in this particular problem. In this problem, we're talking about people getting IDs and being able to vote because they either can or cannot get IDs. A 2% disparity doesn't explain whether they can or cannot get IDs. It's not really relevant to the issue of causation. The issue of causation relates to whether people can go out and get IDs.
You could make a flat statement that it's not relevant if the Supreme Court had held in Thornburg against Gingles that Section 2 is wholly about neutrality and not about disparate effects. But it didn't hold that. It said sometimes disparate impact is bad, but not always. And we're not sure which. Now, I understand your frustration with foggy standards, right? The courts of appeals have been wrestling with the consequences of that for more than 20 years. But here we are, and we need to wrestle. And one can't wrestle with it just by saying, well, here, let's ignore the disparate impact because the law is neutral on its face.
Well, I guess I would point the court, we tried to articulate the standard as we believe it is, of pages 30 and 31 in our reply brief. I can read for you what that is. You may or may not like it, but this is, and we can talk about it then. Section 2 must, in this, and I'm talking about voter ID cases, so I understand that you're looking for a general standard, but I'll try. Section 2 must be read to require that a plaintiff prove not only that a disproportionate number of minorities currently lack a qualifying ID, but that the burdens of obtaining a qualifying ID are substantially more difficult for minority voters. It's so substantial that they would keep a large and disproportionate number of minorities from voting. That is a standard we've argued for in our reply brief.
Well, given the vagueness in what the Supreme Court has said about Section 2, I mean, one can't say that's wrong. It's hard to say it's right either.
Well, this court is in some respects writing on a clean slate, although we do have other circuits that have said, again, simply showing some disparity in possession rates That's not going to win the day. We have other circuits, one after another, as we cited in our brief, saying that. Mm-hmm. Another interesting point is the test that the court comes up with cannot go beyond what the 15th Amendment establishes. So if we have a test here, if you look at page 52 of the district court decision, what the test the court created and then applied relates to whether the new procedure places a burden in the path of minorities.
I'm a little lost. Why can't it go beyond what the 15th Amendment requires independently? Congress can set the requirements for voting at least in federal elections. Put to one side state elections. If Congress passed a statute forbidding the use of voter ID in federal elections, mm-hmm. under Congress's Elections Clause power, I assume you would concede that that's a valid law. It's just like the motor voter law.
Yes, I would. So in this case, we want to watch for a test that, as I'm saying, go back to page 52 of the district court decision. This is a test we have a problem with. In our brief, we put it side by side with the Voting Rights Act. We talk about how the test that the district court created focuses on merely whether a barrier, as the court calls it, is more likely to appear in the path of a minority than a white person. If that is the test, and that's what the district court came up with, it says at page 52, it states that, it gets done saying, I just read the statute, I read Justice Scalia's dissent in Chisholm, and this is the test I'm coming up with. And the next paragraph says, and here's how I'm going to apply that. And then it goes through a lengthy analysis. If the test is only about likelihoods, that is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute. Statute says results in. That means causation. The test must be tied to causation. The test here is wrong. Not only is the test wrong, the facts do not show a violation of the causation standard.
That suggests to me that a Section 2 claim in the voter ID context can only be proven after the law goes into effect and there's some statistical information about voter turnout that can be correlated to the voter ID law, which is tough to do, but maybe it can be done. I don't know.
Right. I understand the issue is you wouldn't want the law to go into effect and then find out later that it shouldn't have been in effect, right? And people, meanwhile, couldn't vote. That wouldn't make any sense. So
isn't that normally what we do with laws? We let them go into effect. We see what consequences they have, and then we judge whether those consequences are bad enough.
Right.
That's why the Supreme Court keeps saying, do not judge the validity of the law on their face, but as applied. You seem to be saying the exact opposite of what we would expect a state government to say.
In that, I'm not saying that they should be judged on their face. I definitely am saying they should be judged on their face. And I see my light is on. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal if I can.
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Ho.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The defendant's case on this appeal is based on a common misperception about the ubiquity of identification cards that is simply not borne out by the record. After a two-week trial featuring over 40 fact witnesses...
Let me say, as I said to Mr. Kosky, I'm not worried about the ubiquity of identification cards. The district court's own findings show that more than 95% of whites and blacks have identity cards or very easily can get them. It's ubiquitous by normal standards. I'm trying to figure out what the significance of this 2% difference between, say, whites and blacks in having qualifying photo ID is. Let me give you a hypothetical, something I think would be equally true factually. You look at the propensity to register to vote. I think it's true that of the voting age population, whites are more likely to register than blacks. Let's suppose in Wisconsin 90% of eligible whites register to vote, 88% of eligible blacks register to vote. 2% difference. In your view, would that make Wisconsin's registration system invalid under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, Judge Easterbrook, I think there are a number of things that would distinguish that case from the registration.
That question has to be answered yes or no, and then you can explain your answer. But first I have to have your answer.
I apologize, Judge Easterbrook. My answer is no. I don't believe...
Now you can explain your answer.
Based on the facts that you've told me, I don't think that would necessarily run afoul of Section 2. Although I do know that other courts have found that onerous registration procedures run afoul of Section 2. So, for instance, the Fifth Circuit in the Operation Push case, which is cited in our brief, affirmed a judgment of the Northern District of Mississippi, which found that that state's registration procedures were onerous and violated Section 2 because of the disparate impact that they had on minority voters. I think there are at least three things that would distinguish that case from this one. The first is, I think that most of us would consider the ordinary burdens of registering to vote under existing federal laws, like the motor voter law, to be a de minimis burden that does not rise to the same magnitude of the burden that the district court found in this case.
Actually, you've just hit on one of the reasons why I asked that particular question. Because one of the arguments in this case is that blacks, because they are on average poorer, are less likely to have cars. And therefore, one would say one of the reasons for the difference that I hypothesized is that blacks are less likely to show up at the Department of Motor Vehicles and be registered automatically under the motor voter statute. And it produces, let us say, a 2% difference. I don't understand why that 2% difference is okay and this 2% difference is not okay.
Well, you know, the National Voter Registration Act is often referred to as the motor voter law because Section 5 is the most, I think, well-known provision of it. But Section 6 of the law provides for mechanisms for people to register to vote by mail. Section 7 permits people to register to vote at social service agencies. So Congress was actually aware that not everyone goes to a motor vehicle agency and provided for other means of registration in this.
But my whole question is, after all is said and done, whites do this more frequently than blacks. The other provisions don't catch up, and so there's a 2% difference in the end. And it can be attributed with some plausibility to economic differences and the probability of car ownership. Now, I asked whether the 2% difference makes for a violation of Section 2, and you said no, but I don't understand, now that you've explained your reasoning, at least the first part of your reasoning, how that's consistent with your position in this case.
Well, Judge Easterbrook, it's not clear to me if your question is about whether or not the magnitude of the difference is sufficient.
That's my first question. I chose 2% because that's the difference between whites and blacks that the district court found in this case. Right? If one said there was a 25% difference, you might have a completely different world. And I expect you would have answered my question yes, because then it might look like some of the onerous procedures, or it might look more like a poll tax. I mean, there's no telling. But I chose 2% advisedly because that's the district court's finding here.
Well, I think it's a slight misstatement of what the district court found, respectfully, Your Honor. The difference was a 2 percentage point difference, not a 2% difference between whites and blacks. And when we're talking about numbers of the magnitude that we're talking about,
The district court found that 2.4% of white voters lacked both ID, photo ID, and birth certificate, and 4.5% of black voters. That means that 97.6% of white voters have it, and 95.5% of black voters have it. Now, you can, of course, make that greater than 2% by using one as the numerator and the other as the denominator, but it's still the case that if you do it over 100, the difference is 2%. That's where my question came from, because I was using the same kind of denominator.
I do think that the relative differences here are significant, because even though it is a 2 percentage point difference, African-Americans do not possess ID at 1.4 times the rate of white voters.
Well, that's putting the white number in the numerator and the black number in the denominator, and it's games with statistics.
Well, I think actually the Sixth Circuit's opinion in Stewart versus Blackwell.
Anyway, I interrupted you after you'd given your first reason. I'd love to hear your other two.
Okay. I think there are two other factors that would distinguish the registration example from this case. The second is the demonstrated link to an undisputed pattern of historical and continuing discrimination in the Wisconsin area. And the reason why that distinguishes this case from registration is that the only way that you can obtain an ID for most people is to visit a DMV, whereas under the National Voter Registration Act, there are multiple methods that are specifically designed to reach people who don't have occasion to go to the DMV. So registration, I think, is a much different situation. And the third thing I would submit, Your Honor, is that there is a valid rationale for having a voter registration practice. Right? Registration allows election officials to know the pool of voters in advance and plan on that basis. There are many good reasons to have a registration law on the books. But in this case, the absolute absence of a non-tenuous justification for Act 23, the absence of evidence suggesting that Act 23 advances a non-tenuous state interest, I think, is a distinguishing factor. Well, one thing that I would like to add, though, Your Honor, is when we are talking about percentages of a very large denominator, as you put it, Your Honor. So we know that there are 300,000 registered voters in Wisconsin who lack Act 23 acceptable identification. So even if the percentages sound small, when you think about it in terms of the total state population and the total registered voter pool, it's quite significant.
What percentage of people in the age group are not registered to vote at all?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What percentage of people 18 or older in Wisconsin are not registered to vote?
Well, actually, in Wisconsin, registration at any sort of given time, if you take a snapshot of the registration picture, doesn't actually tell you who can vote on Election Day because Wisconsin has same-day registration. So anyone can go to the polls who's eligible to vote.
Yeah. Could you just give me a simple answer and not worry about exceptions before we get to the basic rule? If you take the adult, you take the number of registered voters and divide by the adult population, what do you get?
I actually do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
It's interesting in part. I mean, is 300,000 a large or small number relative to that? Maybe that tells you that it's too hard to register in Wisconsin. But if we don't know what that number is, it's hard to compare the difficulties of registration versus the difficulties of getting photo ID, given that you're registered.
Well, what I would submit is that registration is quite easy in Wisconsin, since someone can go to their polling place on Election Day and register to vote.
Okay, so if it's really easy, that's fine. I would still like to know what that numerator and what that denominator are. If it's really easy, we would expect that the numerator and denominator would be really close.
Well, my understanding is that Wisconsin has one of the higher registration rates in the country, but I don't have the precise figure in front of me. If I could, though, I'd like to turn to a question that Judge Sykes, that you raised, about the effect of the NAACP decision on this case. The NAACP decision held that Act 23 imposes severe burdens on voters, but respectfully, Your Honor, it does not itself resolve those burdens, even the cost issue, which Your Honor identified. Given what we know in the record about the DMV's exceptions procedures, the trial court found that those exceptions procedures do not work in practice because they are cumbersome and employed arbitrarily, so they fail to put identification cards into the hands of voters. Now, that finding is amply supported by the record and is not even contested by the defendants.
Well, that was before the saving construction employed by the state Supreme Court.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it's a savings construction of the same provision of the Wisconsin Administrative Code related to transportation, under which the existing exceptions procedures that DMV utilized at the time of trial exist. Those existing exceptions under the exact same provision of the code that the Wisconsin Supreme Court invoked dealt with people who do not have birth certificates and cannot obtain identification cards on that basis. And the evidence at trial demonstrated that numerous voters who fit the bill for that exception were turned away from the Department of Motor Vehicles on multiple occasions. And this is not, I would submit, just a problem of implementation.
Right, but under the new regime, they can't be turned away. All they have to do is invoke the new policy, and the ID has to issue.
Well, that's not... Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not in the record based on what we and based on what we
well,
know.
Well, that's the implication of the Supreme Court's decision.
Well,
and wouldn't that relate to the stay question that's before us as well?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Judge Tinder.
Things have changed because of the Supreme Court rule, so don't we need to consider that in evaluating the request for the stay?
Well, things may have changed, and what effect, if any, these new DMV procedures, which apparently were publicized last night before this argument, may have on the burdens in this case, I would submit, would be best resolved by the district court in the first instance. This court has said that when there has been a change in law or a change in the actual practices of a government agency, that it should not engage in guesswork, but rather permit the district court and its fact-finding capacity.
We are on the eve of an election.
And I think that's precisely why a stay would be inappropriate. in this case, Your Honor. This law was originally designed to have a 9-month implementation period. I mean, even then, there were significant issues with respect to implementation. The former director of the elections division, Mr. Robertson, testified at trial that this is an extraordinarily complicated law, and that even with that 9-month lead-up period, there were implementation issues, poll workers asking for identification in ways and applying the requirements in which they were not supposed to. Executive director of the GAB, in his declaration, Mr. Kennedy, submitted in support of the defendant's stay application, said that he would need to know by September 5th. That date has come and gone. The election, for all intents and purposes, Judge Sykes, starts not in November, but on September 18th, next Thursday, which is the deadline for mailing absentee ballots, which must include the instructions that voters must follow in submitting absentee ballots. No court hearing an identification law challenge has permitted a law to go into effect this close to election, even when courts have sustained laws. I would point Your Honor's attention to the South Carolina decision under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act from 2012, where the court ultimately pre-cleared that law but determined that at this stage, just on the eve of an election, given the complexities that are entailed in this process, it would be inappropriate to try to implement such a law and
have
it go into
effect. We're not in the pre-clearance world here?
No, of course not. Of course not, Your Honor. But I think that the logic underlying that decision applies equally here. Attempting to implement such a complicated law on the eve of an election.
The presumptions run a little differently.
The presumptions do run differently, obviously. We do bear the burden of proof in this case, but I would submit that we've satisfied that. What I would also say about the NAACP procedure is that it best resolves one of the burdens identified by the district court in this case. Now, Mr. Kosky talked a lot about the new procedures that DMV and Vital Records are going to attempt to implement. This is the first that we've heard about these details. But even crediting everything that Mr. Kosky has asserted and assuming that all of this goes off without a hitch, those procedures, which attempt to determine whether or not an applicant for an identification has, say, documents on file with the state of Wisconsin, will do nothing for people who are born out of state. So our client, Eddie Lee Holloway, would not be able to take advantage of it. He would not be able to vote.
Well, it sounds like it permits, again, I haven't seen it because it's new, but it sounds like it permits a vast array of identifying documents to satisfy the criteria for issuance of the photo ID.
Well, Your Honor, this is the first that we've heard of it, and I think that really speaks to the problem and the problems that this court is faced with, trying to make a decision about what effect, if any, this change in law will have on the actual implementation of identification procedures on the ground or an ID requirement at the polling place on an incomplete record. If anything, it suggests that this court should refrain from making a ruling based on this new information that was sprung on the eve of this oral argument. Based on the record that we have, we know that DMV is not the proper safeguard of the most fundamental right that we have in our democracy. This is not an implementation problem. This is baked into the cake when an administrative agency tasked with CARS is supposed to guard our most fundamental right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Ho. Mr. Ewell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is John Ewell, and I represent the plaintiffs in the LULAC against Dininger Action. Your Honor, if the record tells us anything about Wisconsin Act 23 and its voter ID provisions, it is that they are what the Supreme Court in LULAC against Perry described as a troubling blend of politics and race that cannot be sustained under Section 2. On the one hand, Act 23 would deny or abridge the rights of over 300,000 registered Wisconsin voters who lack the IDs needed to vote under the law to vote, a fundamental activity that lies at the heart of our democracy. And those voters, as the district court found on a fulsome factual record, are disproportionately black and Latino. On the other hand...
Well, let's come back. Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Ho. Suppose we look in and discover that 90% of whites register to vote in Wisconsin and 88% of blacks. 2% difference, the same 2% difference the judge found here. Does that make a violation of Section 2 in your client's view?
The answer to your question is it can, Your Honor, and in this case it does. Or the similar discrepancy that found by the court does.
I would fall off my chair if the difference weren't more than 2% in Wisconsin. So your view, your legal view, entails the proposition that the entire Wisconsin voting system, right down to the regulation requirement, is illegal. Right down to the registration.
No, Your Honor, that is not my view.
You just answered my question, yes.
My answer to your question is that it can. My answer to your question is there are cases in which courts, both at the district court and court of appeals level, have found that a difference of a small percentage to 3-4% does violate Section 2. The voting machines cases are the paradigm there, where the courts found that where minority voters vote in counties using faulty voting machinery that rejects in the neighborhood of 4-5% of their votes, but white voters tend more frequently vote in counties using modern voting machinery that rejects only 1-2% of the vote, that those disparities violate Section 2. My answer to your question is in some measure similar to Mr. Ho's answer, which is to say, as the Ninth Circuit said in Salt River and Gonzalez, the mere statistical disparities don't tell you enough to answer the question about whether the law violates Section 2. One must also ask whether those disparities fall more heavily on blacks and Latinos and why, and if those reasons are rooted in a history of racial discrimination, and if the law therefore interacts with...
All of the things you are saying as if qualifications are things that you contend are true in Wisconsin. Right? I'm perfectly happy if you want to own up to the consequence of your legal argument. I get a little nervous when somebody makes all these if statements and then dodges the consequence of them.
If Your Honor's question is, are the disparities identified by the district court in his opinion sufficient in light of the entire trial record that was before the court to establish a Section 2 violation, then my answer is yes, and the court was correct to so find.
The court didn't find that the registration process...
But
the implication is the registration rules are illegal, all the elections held in Wisconsin are illegal because there's probably more than a 2% difference in turnout, and so on.
I don't think that is...
Root and branch.
I don't think that's necessarily the implication, Your Honor. The implication, first of all, is, and it's not an implication, the law is that all voting
practices... Why, on your view, is a 2% difference in turnout on election day not enough to make the election itself a violation of Section 2? If one reason for the difference in turnout is that blacks are less likely to own cars and therefore less likely to be able to drive to the polls.
I think there are, it's a totality of circumstances analysis under Section 2. There are a number of factors that go into that totality. One of them is the importance of the state interest underlying the law. The state interest underlying voter ID has been proven to be a phantom, non-existent. The court found not only that the voter impersonation fraud that the voter ID law is intended to prevent doesn't exist and is not likely to occur in the foreseeable future, but also that the justification of promoting public confidence in the electoral system is not advanced by voter ID laws, and if anything, the law achieves the opposite result.
Those findings are hard to reconcile with Crawford. And I'm not sure that they're classic factual findings anyway, but you know, Crawford validated those interests and declared them important. It's a question of waiting.
Yeah. But in LULAC against Perry, the Supreme Court instructed that having a legitimate interest in the abstract, or even an important interest, is not enough. That interest will still be found tenuous and weigh against a law under Section 2 if, in fact, the law doesn't serve that interest factually on the factual record before the court. What was demonstrated on the facts, and there really was no contrary evidence, is that voter impersonation fraud doesn't exist in Wisconsin. Four task forces over a course of 10 years looked for it and couldn't find it. The state was unable to put forward any evidence on that subject. and the plaintiff's experts demonstrated by their review of available materials that there simply is no evidence of that sort of fraud. So while preventing voter impersonation fraud might be a legitimate interest in the abstract, this law doesn't serve that interest, and therefore the asserted state interest is tenuous and can't justify this law.
I'm not sure that follows. Laws can serve preventative purposes without evidence that voter fraud is rampant or that there have been prosecutions, so that, you know, there's an existing problem that's being responded to. It can be a prevention technique.
And the court analyzed that question as well, and found on the basis of a cost-benefit analysis, as supported by testimony from Barry Burden from the University of Wisconsin, one of our expert witnesses, that the benefits of voter impersonation fraud, adding one vote to the tally, are far outweighed by the burdens associated both with figuring out how to accomplish it, identifying the voter who you would impersonate, knowing where they vote, knowing whether they have voted that day, knowing whether the election officials in that polling place would recognize the person when they walked into the room, and also the criminal penalties associated create a situation where the cost-benefit analysis strongly suggests that it's very unlikely that this problem will occur in the future, and that's consistent with the evidence that it hasn't occurred in the past. So again, while preventing fraud in the future might be a legitimate state interest in the abstract, it's not an interest that this law serves based on the facts that were presented to the district court and upon which the court made findings.
Well, that was actually opinion testimony.
Yes, it was opinion testimony.
You know, it begs the question about whether that's the right way to analyze it.
And the court found that testimony both to be persuasive and credible, and there was no contrary testimony from the state.
Why is that an appropriate way to analyze the question?
Why is it an appropriate way to analyze the question?
I mean, we have a clear statement from the United States Supreme Court that prevention of voter fraud is a valid and indeed important governmental interest in this context. So to have an expert come in and testify on the basis of a cost-benefit analysis sort of runs into the teeth of what the Supreme Court has said about that governmental interest.
Well, I don't think that's the sole evidence, Your Honor. Again, what Lulak versus Perry says is you have to determine.
Just a question that bugged me, and maybe we should discuss it more completely, but some of what's going on here seems to be the Supreme Court said particular things in Crawford. The district judge then holds a trial and say, I find as a fact that the Supreme Court of the United States is wrong, and I now enjoin the statute. Is that a proper relation between the Supreme Court and what the Constitution calls the inferior courts?
Well, the district court did not find that the Supreme Court was wrong. The district court acknowledged, in, for example, with respect to the interest in preventing fraud, that that is a legitimate interest, and
the district judge takes testimony from people who disagree with the Supreme Court and says, I credit their testimony, and I therefore find that there isn't a important interest in deterring fraud, and public confidence isn't something we should worry about, and so on.
I don't think that the court said that at all, Your Honor. I think what the court said is those are legitimate and important interests, and they are not served by this law.
Yes, that's what I mean when I say he took evidence and found the Supreme Court was wrong. The Supreme Court said they are served by laws like this. The district court said, you know, I've taken evidence. I've taken evidence from experts. The Supreme Court is simply wrong. Well, they aren't served by laws like this.
The Supreme Court said in Crawford that it didn't have the factual record necessary to make the evaluation of whether that law...
About the burdens, not about the state interests. You're misreading the opinion.
That's correct, Your Honor. On the other hand, read in all of these, both Crawford and the district court's opinion here, read in the context of Lulak against Perry, which comes from the Supreme Court, tell us that having an abstractly legitimate state interest is not enough to survive Section 2. The law actually has to serve that state interest. It's not enough for the state to stand up and say, we have an interest. The law has to serve that interest, and if it doesn't, then the law is tenuous, and it doesn't justify any incursion on minority voting rights, and what results is a needless abridgment of minority voting rights, which this court has found in Barnett versus the City of Chicago, violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Surely in Barnett, for example, there was an interest, a legitimate interest, in establishing a system for electing aldermen in the city of Chicago, and legitimate interests behind drawing the districts, abstractly legitimate interests behind drawing the districts in the way that that they were. The court found, ultimately, that as applied in that context, the law didn't adequately serve those interests and still found a Section 2 violation.
Why are the redistricting line of cases the appropriate authority to look to here?
Section 2 is a likelihood of is a totality of circumstances analysis. And what the Supreme Court told us in Jingles, and what the Congress that amended Section 2 told us in the Senate report, is that Section 2 applies to all forms of laws that all forms of voting practices and all forms of racial discrimination in voting, be it vote denial or be it vote dilution. And this court also told us that district courts should fashion their tests for Section 2 violations in a manner that addresses the specific violation that's being litigated before them in the jurisdiction where it's being litigated.
Right, and that was my question. Why are the redistricting cases, which are vote dilution cases and focus on the degree of influence a minority group can have, why are those the right barometer here for fashioning an analytical approach to voter ID challenges?
Well, most of the cases in our briefing, we began our briefing with a case like Jingles and Blue Light against Perry, but then when we moved to how the test is applied, we focused more on cases like Gonzalez versus Arizona, Smith versus the Salt River Project, which are vote denial cases. The vote dilution cases provide backdrop and political principles.
I'm asking a why question. You know, I know that other courts have used the Jingles factors and the totality of the circumstances test that's set forth in subsection B of the statute, but why is that a good idea? Because a lot of those factors really don't have any real relevance or import to the inquiry.
Well, the answer to Your Honor's question is it's a totality of circumstances analysis, and it's one analysis, it's one test that is established by the statute for all forms of voting discrimination. But, as Your Honor rightly points out, it has to be applied in a way that focuses on the challenge that's being made, and that's what the district court did here. The district court did not blindly apply a standard that was developed from the vote dilution cases. In fact, he said, as Your Honor has, the vote dilution cases are of some relevance, but things like the Senate factors are not necessarily relevant to my inquiry here, and therefore he considered some of the evidence and some of the points that would support a Senate factors analysis, but did not apply a full Senate factors analysis. He analyzed the totality of circumstances somewhat differently.
You had some help from the United States as an amicus here?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
And the Justice Department took the position that this case is an as-applied challenge to Act 23, not a facial challenge. Do you agree with that?
We do. Obviously, the law is not currently being applied.
You didn't ask for an as-applied remedy. You asked for a facial remedy and, in fact, got a whopper of a facial remedy.
We asked for a remedy that, and the court granted it, that the court enjoin voter ID in Wisconsin going forward because it...
In perpetuity.
Well,
unless permission is received from the district judge.
Unless the state returns to the district judge and shows changed circumstances that might alter whether a voter ID law is permissible.
That's a fairly extraordinary facial remedy. So the case can't be an as-applied case.
It's a remedy that's appropriate to the violation that the court found, and as this court has found, district courts have the discretion to enjoin conduct that is related to but broader than the conduct that was found to be violative in order to protect the rights that it found were violated. Your Honor, I can continue, but I see my time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ulan. Anything further, Mr. Koski?
Thank you. I'll try and be brief. We're asking that this court would issue a stay of the injunction to immediately put this law into place today. And we believe that that is important because obviously government agencies need to begin doing things if this law is going to be in place for the November election. I want to reference the September 5th date that was discussed in Mr. Kennedy's declaration. I think Mr. Ho maybe unintentionally sort of misrepresented what that said. It talks about the September 18th date as being key because that is the date that instructions would have to go out for the mailing of absentee ballots. This court still has plenty of time to issue an order staying the injunction to allow this law to go into place. With that, I would say that...
Mr. Kosky, you said that the new rules implementing the Supreme Court of Wisconsin's decision were issued last night and available on the state governor's website. During the argument, I looked on the website. I found a press release, but no set of policies or regulations.
Yes.
That may reflect my own incompetence as a researcher, but where is it?
So I looked this morning too, Judge Easterbrook, and the website where it should be is health.wisconsin.gov/admrules/public/search. From there, you can search for the DOT's rules. And
a nice, nice, easy URL. That
exactly, right? Right? Exactly my thoughts. We will be filing those today with you,
and
so you can see
and
them.
Would you also file perhaps a short version of that URL? There are websites that produce short and comprehensible URLs. That would help.
Is it going on the GAB website?
It can, if that's convenient. I would say that, and I'll point out one last point with regard to these rules. They're intended to cover, there are different levels of types of problems people could have. We talked about the level of someone who has a Wisconsin birth certificate, but it's unavailable to them. Another level is someone who has an out-of-state birth certificate, and they don't have it. They come to DMV, they don't have it. DHS is working with other states now to communicate with those states to find out if those people have birth certificates. That process is not final, but they're working with every state to make sure that we can verify that these folks have birth certificates.
I understand the enforcement of this law has been enjoined. Has the run-up for it, was that stopped?
No, it was not.
It continued despite the injunction.
And Judge Tinder, a couple things there. The issuance of free IDs has been going on really since 2011. People have still been going to the DMV and getting free IDs for the purposes of voting in anticipation of this law going into place. The district court's injunction says that the GAB and election officials cannot require the presentation of an ID. It does not enjoin the issuance of free IDs. And in fact, on August 21st, this court entered an order saying that basically it's okay to go ahead with the NAACP exception procedure. So that is the remainder of my remarks. I would just ask that this court immediately issue a stay today so that this law could go into effect and reverse the judgments of the district court, vacate the injunction. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. The case is taken under advisement.